You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, 7:07 in the morning. You're on the Wake Up Tucson show, 10:30 The Voice, local news and talk. Christy Simone, Tommy Callahan on the other side of the glass. We have coming up at the bottom of the hour, Franca Fugliosi, the FBI way. And then we have author John Kim in the third hour. And of course, making his Thursday appearance is Congressman David Schweikert. David, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So, seems like you had a kind of a quiet week in D.C. this week.
Yeah, I mean, the last couple weeks have been, the chair massages, the manis and petties.
So let's talk about impeachment yesterday. How did that go?
the odd thing on the impeachment, it was actually, it's a big deal. It's, obviously weaponized, but the earlier impeachment and other impeachment attempts, because remember, this isn't the second one. It's, there were a couple other failed attempts earlier.
Yes.
You saw how serious the Democrats were taking it. The Republicans were, and this time it's almost like this is the routine when the Democrats are in charge is, well, there's a gentleman in the White House we don't like, file an impeachment. It was also, I'm not sure if I had the proper words to describe. There's still a lot of members of Congress who are trying to get their heads around everything that happened last week.
Right.
And then at the same time to have this impeachment on top of it, there's just, you find yourself having these debates on the facts. What did the president do? Did he do this? Did he do that? Is this good for our society when you're, a week away from the transition of power? Is this really how you want the Biden administration to start, their first term? And, then you're dealing with the rumors that a number of Democrats are raising money, off the impeachment because, let's face it, Donald Trump has been their cash cow.
Correct.
And so you're not happy on, personally on the presidential election, but you have this, you want to get to work because we haven't done actual work in such a long time.
When was the last time what was the last year you can remember Congress doing actual work?
We were grinding it out, even though the Democrats were in charge. If you go back to basically January, early February of 2000. So it's been a year. There were some bills where, we were going back and forth because you were forced to come up with policies that may not have made you happy, but at least worked because you had to get it through the Senate. You had to get it to the White House. And
you said 2000? What was it?
No, excuse me, 2020, sorry.
Oh, 2020.
I got in like 1 in the morning last night, so I'm only on my second coffee.
I was going to say, you weren't in Congress in 2000.
No. No, so it's been a year.
Yes, okay.
It's been a year. So we functionally, under the Nancy Pelosi's leadership, we've squandered a year where this has been just a brutal, let's face it, 9 months. The last 9 months to people in this country. And if there was ever a time you needed your Congress to function, it's been this last 9 months.
Well, one of the things we've learned from talking to you and having you on the show, right, is that the federal budget's broken up into 7 parts, correct?
Well, that's often how the appropriations bills,
correct,
come through, yes. And there, I will warn you, there's been times it's been broken up in even more than that.
That's fine. I'm okay with that. As long as you guys are working on the various parts, debating, marking, whatever that you need to do and voting on it, instead of this omnibus crap that always happens at the last second.
Mm-hmm.
So when was the last time you guys actually did a real budget? actually did the process the way you're supposed to do it?
Oh, it's been years and years. Because remember, there's a bit of a con job that happens here. When you hear a member of Congress talk about the budget, there's a budget committee, it produces a budget. That's sort of the box. And then there's the appropriations committee that actually appropriates money that also is supposed to be appropriated to authorizing committees.
Right.
That say this is the program we are supporting. But the con is you can often have things that are authorized that don't actually get appropriated, or if they possibly get appropriated, they'll negotiate away from that because it doesn't fit into the budget box.
Right.
And what the Democrats just did in this new rules package this last week is they changed the budget rules. So we've had this thing. It's been substantially a fraud, but at least it gave something to hang on called PAYGO.
Right.
Pay as you go. We're not going to, go beyond these certain budget limits. Now, part of the con was on big programs. A good one example was a decade ago, SNAP. The CHIP program. Important program, but you appropriate it on year 1 through 5, and on the fifth year, you pretend it has no spending.
Right.
And that way you can fit it into the PAYGO rules. Well, this time they just decided, hey, this pay-as-you-go rules, it's too burdensome. We're just going to almost make it go away. So the whole budgeting process is functionally screwed up, broken. And when it does supposed to restrain excess crazy spending, they just break the rules.
Well, we also changed the rules that it's okay to call people white supremacists on the floor of the House. So it's a nice rules package there.
But if you also saw the first rules package that was introduced, if you're a member of Congress and you say something that the majority deems uncomfortable or they're unhappy with, and your social media or other places, you are marched off to the Ethics Committee. So it's something we've also talked about over and over and over the last couple of years since the Democrats took over. Everything's weaponized, whether it be wearing a mask on the floor or walking through a metal detector. Now your language. And I don't think members of Congress like myself should point it out. We should be unhappy about it. But it's more than us. This is happening all over society. I talk to people who are afraid to go into their work parking lot with any type of conservative bumper sticker on for fear that it will cause them trouble at their employment. That just shows you how sick our modern politics have become.
All right, let's do this. Let's do one more segment together. And when I come back, I'm going to use a phrase that'll get me in trouble with the Ethics Committee. We're going to put on our big boy pants, right?
And let's try to find something positive because it's been a crappy couple weeks.
Well, what I want to do is I want to talk to you about Republicans now who are disheartened. Some of them want to walk away. Mm-hmm. It's all. What do we really need to do as a party over the next, 12 to 24 months to get back on the playing field and do this right? Okay?
Yeah, let's do it.
Is that okay?
And I'm going to hit you with a theme that those folks who are disheartened, you have every right to be. You're also proof that the Democrats have accomplished exactly what they intended to do to you.
All right, let's go. We'll do that with Congressman David Schweikert coming back on Wake Up Tucson. 7:20 in the morning. You're on the Wake Up Tucson show. We got to get right back to our friend Congressman David Schweikert on the line. David, welcome back, sir.
Okay.
So let's let's get into it. The tease was we have listeners out there who are some of them are somewhere between a little disheartened to very disheartened.
And look, that's part of the political tactics. In some ways, it's a bit of dark humor I'm going to share with you, but how much of also one of the goals of the impeachment is to continue to just beat on the psyche of, Trump supporters, of Republicans, and, you know, you just keep coming at them, because if you can crush your opposition's enthusiasm, you win. And the best example I can give you of how political professionals, Democrats, would approach this. In 2016, think of some of the Democrat acquaintances you have, and the world had come to an end. The Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and now they had this, Donald Trump got elected. It was Armageddon. Yep. And so what did they do? Well, they had used lots of antidepressant medication, and then they held some big-ass rallies, huge rallies everywhere. They burned a lot of cars. And then they began the resist movement. They pumped huge amounts of money into a lot of their political causes. They did training seminars everywhere for political activists on how to identify and move and motivate and actually win elections. And 2 years later, 2018 hit, and they wiped out the Republican majorities. They took over a number of state legislatures. It's how come their side takes an emotionally crushing defeat, just like we're going through, and turned it into they were going to be better at their politics.
So I want to add something to this. So I was talking to a good friend of the show, Taylor, yesterday, and his dad, Gary. They've both been on the show, and we were talking about the work that the Democrats did leading up to the 2020 elections. And he talked about his dad had a great thing where, talking about the sports analogy, right? Champions are built on the practice field, right? And the Democrats did a great job on the practice field for the last 2 to 4 years, while the Republicans showed up kind of late to the game and said, we'll be fine, Trump's going to carry us over the line. That was my take. Yeah. But the champions are built off the field, on practice field. Is that now something that the Democrats definitely did? I assume they, sounds like they did better than Republicans.
They did at the presidential level. The Senate map was just difficult. But at the House of Representatives, we did actually quite well. We're only a few votes away from snatching the majority back. And that's one of the other things you're going to continue to see, the Trump derangement, I believe, for the next couple of years. And primarily, they desperately must keep a wedge between suburban voters who are antsy about the current president, and Republican members of who are running for Congress, particularly in a time where there's redistricting, where there's going to be a lot of new lines. Because if all you need is a few more wins and you take back the House, and in Congress, you know, the House is a majoritarian body. If you have the majority, you run all the rules, you do everything, unlike the Senate, where almost any one senator can gum up the works. So, you know, it's one of those, take a big breath, and then figure out how we do, if you're an activist, how do you do it better? And some of this is not going to sound warm and fuzzy, but is 3 hours of standing on a corner waving a flag as effective as 3 hours walking through a targeted neighborhood and knocking on doors and actually talking to people?
Right.
I remember, it was in part of my district. There was this very large rally going on just a couple weeks before the early ballots got mailed. And lots of folks out there with flags standing on corners and waving. And the very neighborhood next to this intersection had about a dozen Democrats. They were a paid group, but out there walking door to door and going through the apartment buildings.
Right.
They had a dozen. There were probably 75 out waving flags. But who actually got closer to winning the election that day?
The 12 Democrats.
Yep, because they were knocking on doors and actually talking to targeted voters instead of waving at people who are already with you. And that's hard because it requires organization, it requires data, it requires discipline. Guess what we have to find? We have to find the data and that discipline and then the energy to go do it.
As part of that, what do Republicans, we'll start in our own state of Arizona, what do we need, does election reform in the state of Arizona need to get done?
Yes, but it doesn't have to be completely wholesale. There's just a number of audits and controls, some of the timing rules that just need to be tightened up. And then we actually have to look at, can we do some identification of who's ballot harvesting? Because ballot harvesting is illegal in Arizona. Can we come up with some methodologies to keep that from happening?
Well, I believe there's no actual penalty, is there, that they associated with?
I thought there was a penalty. The problem was I think it's proving it.
Right.
And in 2018, we put together something called heat maps. Almost showing, saying, how is it possible that people from this very large apartment complex all dropped their ballots all on the same day?
Right.
And then suddenly that precinct had substantially more Democrat voters than normal. I mean, you look at the map, you go, okay, but we couldn't find a law enforcement out there that was interested at least going to the next step of doing the interviews or just searching to find out, was there illegal ballot harvesting that election? And so 2 years later, when we believe a lot of it also happened, whose fault is that? Is it those who cheated, or is it also, yes, it's their fault, but it's also those of us who saw it 2 years earlier and couldn't get law enforcement or the proper folks to go out and say, will you at least take a look at this and see if the pretty maps we've made you showing it are real?
Did they any of your committee assignments change this upcoming 2 years?
We don't know yet.
Okay.
We're still having a fight with the Democrats, actually Speaker Pelosi, on something called ratios. This is inside baseball.
We got about a minute, so.
It's just how many members from each party go onto a committee. And that makes a difference. I'm on a unique committee. When you're on Ways and Means, it's committee assignments you choose by seniority. It's not at the whims of the senior Republican, senior Democrat on the committee. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to get on that committee.
So there's a good shot you might get back on Ways and Means.
Oh, no. I'm on Ways. Yeah, once
okay.
You're there, it's because it requires so much specialization. When you do the tax code, it just consumes your entire staff every moment. It's one of the reasons you're often, you're just really never on other committees.
Gotcha. All right. Well, David, thanks for the half hour as always. I appreciate it. And good luck and stay strong out there.
Well, let the battles continue. Let's just figure out a way to do it smarter.
All right, buddy. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye now.
We got Frank Filiuzzi coming up the FBI way. Wake up Tucson, 10:30 The Voice, local news and talk. Remember my Italian cooking classes tomorrow night, flyingaprons.tucson.com if you want to join us, 5:30. I think tomorrow's, because we're going to celebrate the Italian cooking class, it has to be Goomba music or even music by Goombas. So that includes Bon Jovi and Satriani. See what I'm saying? So we're going all Italian tomorrow. It'll be a Sinatra, Perry Como. We're doing it all. Wake up. All right, 7:36 and a half in the morning. You're on Wake Up Tucson, 10:30 The Voice, local news and talk. Been trying to introduce you to a variety of new books as we enter into the new year. The one we're going to talk about right now is called The FBI Way. And on the phone, line 17, Frank Filiuzzi. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris, I like the little addition of the Italian accent there. Thank you.
That's what we do here. This is what we do. So what part of the country are you originally from?
I'm originally from Connecticut.
Okay.
The FBI career took all over the United States, and now, right now, I'm down the street from you in the Catalina foothills.
Look at you. So let's talk about give people a little bit of your a resume before we get talking about the book. Let's talk about that first. Let's give them a little feel of who Frank is.
Yeah, sure, Chris. I spent 25 years as a special agent with the FBI, assigned to cities all over America like Miami, Atlanta, San Francisco, Cleveland, Washington, D.C. five times. Rose up through the ranks to lead the counterintelligence division of the FBI and retired as assistant director a few years ago. Since then, I've been a talking head, that's a talking Fed, on NBC and MSNBC News as a national security contributor.
We forget.
I've already
you.
Been. On, yeah. No, you're not going to hold that against me?
Not right now. We're okay.
Maybe later. Maybe later. Yeah, I've been on about 1,000 times, and I've done something now that I never thought I'd do. I wrote a book, The FBI Way, Inside the Bureau's Code of Excellence. We can talk about the message in the book and why I wrote it and did something that I didn't think I'd do, talk about the inside scoop of the
FBI. Why didn't you think you were going to write a book about this kind of stuff or write a book at all?
You know, I didn't want to be one of those guys who, you know, writes the tell-all or gets out and writes a political book. And I we've had enough of that, and we've had enough politicizing of the FBI. So I decided, though, that after 4 years in the current administration of hearing the agency I love castigated, sometimes, by the way, at its own doing, we can talk about that as I do in the book, I thought I would dedicate a book to the rank and file men and women of the FBI because their mission's been made all the more harder by a public perception that somehow the agency is politicized. And again, like I say, a couple of people were responsible for that, Comey, Jim Comey, Pete Strzok, but I'm here to tell you and your listeners that the FBI performs at the highest level of excellence, especially when it matters the most, when the stakes are the highest, like right now in this country. And I learned over 25 years some leadership lessons about leadership that preserves values both inside the organization, where for times in my career, Chris, I was part of the internal affairs mechanism in the FBI, even the chief inspector of the FBI. And the message of the book is you don't have to spend 25 years inside the FBI to learn how to protect your values, how to lead with values at the core of what you do, whether you're leading a classroom, a community, a corporation, or now even a country. I distilled it down for us into what I call the 7 C's and called the book The FBI Way.
So we'll get to the politicization part that, you know, I think the average, like you said, the people who are the rank and file doing the good work have to struggle with the perception of that. But what's the of your 7 C's, you said 7, right? There's 7. Of the 7, give me number 1. What is the number 1 C in the FBI Way?
Yeah, it turns this as the number 1 chapter because everything flows from this if you're a leader looking to preserve values and looking to perform with excellence. And that C is code. Code means how should we conduct ourselves in our family, our company, our country? What are our core values? I find so many times, even consulting with corporations, and I did private sector work after the FBI, that if you ask somebody at a company who it is that's responsible for enforcing a code of conduct, integrity, ethics, they'll point down the hall and say, it's that department down there. They do standards and compliance. But what this is about is everyone understanding a code, everyone being on the same sheet of music. And the FBI does that with exceptionally well, starting with who they bring in the door as an employee, and then at the FBI Academy from day one, and I tell the story of what the FBI Academy experience is like, they tell you you're responsible for this code. And let me tell you, on day one, when you're on the firearms range and they say move forward to score your target, and you realize no one is scoring your target except you, that it's an honor code, that your integrity starts right now, and they're watching you, that's how they start it. And you can do that in your company, your country, your family. The next C is conservancy, which is the idea that collectively we need to all have the same values. We are all responsible stewards of the values of this company, this community, this country. And I got to tell you, I think many Americans have lost their way on the concept of code and conservancy. We're not rowing in the same direction. We think some elected official is going to tell us what our values are. We think some agency is going to protect our values for us. And yeah, the FBI does that. We've got to do this ourselves. This isn't something you take for granted. The next C, the next chapter is consequences.
Now, Frank, I'm going to interrupt you because I feel like I have more time with you because you're in the same city I am, but I don't. I'm going to lose you in like 2 minutes, according to your PR people. So, let's do this. Can we continue this conversation another day where we can go a little longer on this? Because I mean, especially since you're a Tucson guy now, I would love to do that.
Neighbors. Tucson is special to me, and I'd continue the conversation, not only about the book, but the situation our nation finds ourselves in now and needs to deal with moving forward.
So let's do this. I want to get you, I don't want to crimp you on your time because I know you're making the rounds today. So before you hang up, can you give Tom your contact information and email and stuff that we can get a hold of you and rebook this for a longer discussion? Would that be okay?
Absolutely, and I think we also have some additional time now, but I'm happy to come back on, Chris.
I'm just going by your PR people are telling me I have you till 9:45, which is a minute and a half from now.
All right. Well, so, you've been very gracious in allowing me to talk about the book, The FBI Way. Let's do it again, Chris.
I'd love to do it. So please give your information to Tom before we leave, and then we'll go long ball on this very, very soon, okay?
Awesome. Stay safe.
You too. Good talking to you. Frank Figluzzi. The book is called The FBI Way. Wake up, Tucson. 10:30, The Voice. I remember listening to an interview on Eddie Trunk on XM with her husband, Neil Giraldo.
Neil Giraldo, yep.
And he was talking about how all the kids hated him in the house, like when they were teenagers, because all he does is work on melodies and stuff. Like he's in the middle of dinner, and all he's working on is jazz like that. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, did you talk about you had something in high school today? I'm just like working on stuff. It was one of the more, I didn't know it was going to be that interesting of a conversation with him, you know, because he just looks like, yeah, he's the guy who was the guitarist who married Pat Benatar, but smart guy, slick cat.
It's amazing how much stuff he's done.
Yep.
Quick Neil Giraldo trivia note. He played guitar on Jesse's Girl because the producer hated the way Rick Springfield played guitar and actually kicked him off his own track. And so we're going to bring Neil in to play the guitar on this track because you stink.
That's true. Rick's got a nice voice. I got it. He's written a couple of decent songs.
Handsome guy.
Handsome. Absolute handsome. Handsome Dan. But at the same time, he shouldn't be playing guitar.
Right.
It happens. He can do a little rhythm backup kind of stuff. He can strum. I got it. But, don't be playing solos or too much of a lead. It's not your bag, baby.
Neil was a big session monster, before really hooking on and up, I guess, with Pat.
Correct. But,
man, what a great duo, though.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
When you say, like, the top five ladies of rock and roll, she's there.
Absolutely.
So, God bless her. And of course, she made short haircuts very, very popular. So I always love in Fast Times at Ridgemont High when all the girls have the cool girls have the Pat Benatar haircut.
Yeah.
So let's get to my favorite, one of my favorite pinatas in the world. Can I say pinatas? Is that cultural appropriation? Let me go to Rahina and Lane. Can I say pinata? I'm still going with it. One of my favorite pinatas is Pima County. They have sucked so much money out of the taxpayers to do so little. And they've done an amazing job in economic indentured servitude on the economic poor and working class family that really needs some help. And they've been letting them down since Grijalva and Ekstrom were up there doing their thing. But let's get to, so we know, if you listen to the show for years, they suck at maintaining stuff, right? They don't use road money for roads. Our roads are some of the worst in the west of the Mississippi on the planet. We don't care, other than the Keno soccer fields, which not many people play on, and all the kids on the south side couldn't go play it because they have big giant fences around it, because if you're not paying as FC Tucson or a tournament, you can go to heck. We just found out that there's grave sites at Evergreen that they're in charge of taking of veterans and pioneer families, and they don't take care of that either, all right? And we know they don't fund police staffing enough. And they turned down $2 million of Stone Garden that they've been taking for years because, at the time, the sheriff was Mark Napier. So we don't do roads, parks, grave sites. I'm trying to think, what else? There's various things that they've been, and again, their budget's always north of decades, probably somewhere north of a billion. That's with a B. Okay. Well, here's the other one. Now, there's only two counties in the state of Arizona that can't roll out the vaccines in a timely manner. One is La Paz County on the west side of Arizona. And the largest city in La Paz is the wonderful Quartzsite, Arizona. Just so you want to get a little feel for where La Paz. Because I know when you were kids and you took your Arizona government class and your teacher had you remember, you had to list all the counties in Arizona. That's the last time you thought about La Paz. But congratulations to La Paz and Pima County. You two are the slowest in rolling out vaccines. You really do suck again. So here's the best part. You got $85 million in CARES money. $20 million went to a useless contact tracing that you've even admitted stinks. $32 million went to employee vacation time. $3.4 million went to the warehouse on tool for PPE and vaccine storage that's still empty. You say you ran out of the $85 million and you need more. And if you don't get more from the state and the feds, you're going to have to raise the Pima County taxpayers' tax bill via the Chuck Huckleberry written op-ed with Sharon Bronson's name on it a couple of Sundays ago. And you suck at rolling out the vaccine. And we have Adelita Grijalva and Sharon Bronson want to renew this fool for another 4 years. Rex Scott and Matt Hines, what do you need? What am I missing here that you would say, oh, give this broski? Here's the thing. Let's say Chuck Huckleberry was some sort of uber Republican, right? Let's forget about that. Let me start this from the beginning. Let's say it was Doug Ducey's fault for not rolling out, getting people vaccinated fast enough, right? Timmy Steller, Dylan Smith, Sarah Gass, and all of you would pigpile on him that Doug Ducey's killing Arizonans because he's not rolling out the vaccine fast enough. Chuck Huckleberry, at somewhere between $300,000 to $400,000 a year, which means he makes 3 to 4 times more a year than the governor of Arizona. Doug makes $95,000. Okay, Chuck is making, by the time he cashes out vacay pay, he's probably pushing $4,000. Okay, so the guy who is down with La Paz County, as you can't get people vaccinated fast enough, is getting a free pass from the entire press corps in Tucson. Because you can't, because he's the favored guy. Oh, and, you know, your fellow ex-press people like Mark Evans and Pat McNamara work for Huckleberry. Well, we can't make that uncomfortable. But I'm telling you, if it was Doug Ducey who wasn't, I mean, you're half of you already say he's killing people because he doesn't lock down and ruin everyone else's life, existence, and whatever. But we are, again, if it wasn't for La Paz County, largest city Quartzsite, we would be the worst county in the state in getting people vaccinated. Now, for all of you who believe this vaccination thing, we got to get it done. We got to get it done fast. You are living in one of the worst counties in Arizona in relation to trying to make anyone safe. They'll stand on the hill for that stupid curfew, but it's okay that the county can't vaccinate you people. So when you people sit there and, like, you know, what will happen is you'll see on Facebook, someone says, hey, we need to keep Arizona open. We need these businesses going. And you go, hey, man, my aunt died and you just want people to die. Well, none of us really want anyone to die. We're trying to mitigate damage across the board. Not just COVID people, but, you know, people who are dying of heart attacks at their house because they didn't go to their doctor because they don't think the doctor's going to see him because of the Rona. Right? Or all those people who died prematurely because elective surgeries were put on the shelf for a few months. That's what we're trying to do. So, but all of you people who are pissed off at people that don't want to have lockdowns, or you're pissed off at Doug Ducey, can you be pissed off at Ramon Valadez, Sharon Bronson, Betty Villegas, Chuck Huckleberry, and Adelita Grijalva for being the second to worst county in vaccinating people? That's something that's really, if you want everyone vaccinated and fast as possible. Chuck Huckleberry at $300,000 to $400,000 a year is the second to worst county in the state in getting people vaccinated. So when they tell you we're serious about getting this Rona under control, I don't see it. It's a joke. Is this a joke? I mean, he's been pounding on everyone on this Rona crap. And all of you business leaders that are on the county back to business with the chamber fools and all that stuff, and you've been kissing Huckleberry's rear end the last so many months. This is the time where you're supposed to find some sort of inner guts and say, hey, bro, why do we suck so bad at getting people vaccinated? If you're a vaccine person as a business leader and you think getting more people vaccinated and getting this under control is better for the business community of Tucson, Arizona, and the region, you need to get out there and say, hey, what are you guys doing? Is this a joke? Thank God KGUN9 covered this story. Again, I keep telling you, all of the people in the press, right? The Dillons, the Ninsels, the Stellers, always look on down their nose at the TV people because they're all pretty and they got great hair and three bottles of Aquanet holding that hair up on the screen. You know something? They're better journalists than you are. So again, let's be fair. Let's be intellectually honest. If it's Doug Ducey's fault, because we're not having the entire state lockdown, that everyone's dying or everyone's getting tested positive and whatever's going on with the Rona, then you need to be pissed off at the Democrats on the council and Chuck Huckleberry and Teresa Cullen, old Dr. Cullen, because they're one of the worst counties in the state at getting out the vaccine. But I'm sure Rex Scott is going to follow whatever Adelita Grijalva tells him to go, let's give him another 4 years for 1.3 mil. It'll be fine. I'm sure. When are you guys ever going to get pissed off? I don't know. We'll see. Enjoy your $80,000 salaries.